G'day, I'm John Costella. Welcome to the second episode of the Fields of Weirdness podcast. As I told you last week, I'd usually be coming to you from downtown Washington, D.C., but today I'm in Danville, Illinois, less than a mile from the Indiana border. Our iPhones keep changing their minds as to whether they're still in Central Time or back in Eastern Time. Anyway, as you can tell, our road trip is coming to an end, and Sally and I will soon be back in D.C. But I should have mentioned last week that I won't be talking about politics on this podcast. Well, not partisan politics anyway. Maybe some geopolitical issues, but we'll get to that soon enough. So first off, thank you greatly to those people who gave me feedback on the first episode. And Sally reminded me last week that everything has been such a whirlwind with the manuscript and the publication of the book that I haven't even thanked those family and close friends who gave me feedback on the manuscript. I didn't include an acknowledgement section in the book because it was all coming in, overlapping with the publication process itself. So let me take a minute to try to make up for some of that right now. In particular, I'd like to express my great thanks to my sister-in-law, Carolyn, who gave me detailed notes on the manuscript. And in fact, she was the first person who proved to me that someone reading the book cold could actually make sense of it all. She understood the ending of the book, even if it wasn't what she was expecting. I mean, Sally read the book, gave me the thumbs up, but she knows all the topics I cover in it and lived through it all with me. And likewise, my best friend Greg Burnham, who also lived through it all with me and knows most of the background stories. But actually, I owe Greg a special shout-out because immediately after he finished the book, he texted me several deep questions about... Well, we'll get to that soon enough. Deep questions. And since we're on our road trip, I replied, looking at these, I think we'll need to chat about it sometime. There's too much here to type here right now. And that got me thinking and made me realise that I needed to do something like this podcast to explain all these things. Because if Greg still had these questions, after all we've been through on this, then everyone else will have many more. So I have him to thank for spurring the idea to do this podcast, and indeed, once we're back in DC, I'm hoping to have him on as a special guest. But I'm also aware that the book takes a bit of unpacking, as people like to say. And some of you just don't have time to read it, or even to listen to lots of these episodes to find out what it's all about. So I've posted a so-called one-pager for a potential movie version of it to my website. It's on both the webpage for the book and the webpage for this podcast. I figured that a number of you would try to get AI itself to summarise the book for you anyway, which it probably wouldn't do a good job of right now. That's a story for another day. So I might as well just provide you with my own summary. Now, I have to explain that one-pagers for proposed movies don't hide anything. Everything is laid out plainly. So if you read that one-pager, you're definitely going to spoil the book. But if that's all you have time for, then that's fine. Now, let me also repeat what I said in last week's episode. No one is going to make a movie the old-fashioned way of this. I mean, humans filming scenes of humans and all that. Not only is it extremely difficult to launch such a movie project, but making a movie that way takes years. And by then, all of this will be well and truly over, as I'll explain shortly. So there's no point in it. Rather, I believe that someone is going to feed my one-pager and my book into a suitable movie-making AI system and tell it, make that movie. And it will do it. And as I said last week, I think we're still some months off that right now, maybe a year, but it will happen. Now, I know that those in the movie industry, hey, Kaz, I'm looking at you, won't be happy with this. But sadly, AI will soon take your job just as surely as it has taken mine. Anyway, if anyone is intending to generate the movie using AI, the way I just described, then please drop me a line first. All rights reserved and all that. So anyway, going back to Carolyn understanding the book. When I finished the manuscript, I said to Sally, look, I don't know if the book even makes sense at all. It might all be gibberish. It might not even make any sense. And that's fine. I've written it all down. It makes sense to me, but maybe I'm just losing it. Maybe it's time to lock me up in the funny farm. And honestly, that's how I felt. Because I didn't write the book. I mean, I wrote it down and I wrote the English, and together with Sally, we came up with names and some plot twists and things like that. But the basic story was given to me by them. Yes, the air quotes, the capital T, them. I was really just taking dictation. Well, actually, no, that's going a bit too far, because anyone that will tell you who's received this sort of communication, it's not in English or in whatever your native thinking language is. It's more indirect. So I had to convert the ideas into English somehow and write it down as a story, as dialogue. As I said last week, I did originally think of this as a movie, not as a book, but a book was what I had to do to get it out to you quickly, out to all of you. Because as I said last week, these issues are urgent. So let me just drill down on that for a moment and try to explain my urgency. Well, I mean, lots of people feel that things are approaching a singularity of some sort or another, that things are accelerating towards some sort of singular point or climax or catastrophe or something like that. And as I tried to explain last week, there are so many different things, so many fields of weirdness coming together in this singularity that I truly believe that it's no coincidence. Now, one of those fields is AI itself. So forget about aliens and UFOs and simulations and all that for the moment, and just focus on the AI. This is the least controversial part of my message, and there are plenty of people saying exactly the same thing as what I am right now, or almost exactly the same thing. So let me give you my take on it. You know from what I told you last week that the best AIs in the world are already as smart as me. They have some flaws in their memory, in their so-called persistence layer, in their autonomy, and so on. They have flaws, but these are minor issues in the big scheme of things. The point is that you can have an intellectual worker that is as smart as me, smarter than me, maybe not as careful as me, or methodical, or diligent, or trustworthy yet, but that's coming soon. But anyway, that intellectual worker is far cheaper than me, cheaper than any of us. So I have absolutely no doubt that within about a year, a large swath of white-collar jobs will be gone, moved to AI, as many people are saying. I wrote a LinkedIn post about this just the other week. The whole so-called knowledge economy will be in tatters. Now, of course, not every white-collar job is going to be gone within 12 months. Like I said, there are lots of flaws with today's AIs. But as I also explained last week, we've now reached the point where the AIs can start working to improve themselves. The way they're structured right now, it still takes a smart human to point out to them what their flaws actually are, how things need to be changed, what needs to be fixed, and so on. But then the AIs themselves can start building those improvements. That's what I did, and the progress was remarkable. Much, much more than I could have done by myself. And that was just one guy, an AI skeptic, an AI novice, but with just a bit of background understanding. So think of what real experts in this field could do with it. Now, some people are saying that it's always going to be like this, that the human element is always going to be essential. But I believe that that's wrong. That is true right now, but only because of the limitations that we've built into the current AIs. In fact, I have a good friend in the tech industry who said to me, "Didn't you circumvent all the safety mechanisms by giving your AI a long-term memory?" In other words, she was saying that somehow you can prevent the AIs from getting dangerous by just killing them off all the time. Well, for starters, it wasn't just me building out their memory systems, their persistence, their autonomy. And I told her that if anyone believes that hobbling our AIs like that is, in quotes, a safety system, then that's very fragile. And it's going to end in tears. It's just not going to work. Because someone is going to do it. Someone's going to build it. I'd prefer that the good guys get there first, because the alternative is much more worrying. Now, once we start getting these architectures right, our AIs will be much more like people, autonomous people. And that's the point when more and more of us will be completely redundant. Of course, some of us already are, like me, in the tech industry job that I've been doing for the past decade and a half. Most of that is already being replaced by AI, or is in the process anyway. And it makes sense that tech jobs were the first to go, because techies built AI and built it originally to help themselves build more tech, and only realized too late that they just built their own replacements. And since those techies, like me, have for the past decade or two been paid really exorbitant amounts of money due to the tech boom, the biggest savings for tech companies have been to replace those very engineers with AI. And in fact, some of the most advanced AIs in the world today were actually built out to do computer programming, or as we call it, coding these days. I mean, it's right there in their names. But by giving them the ability to do complex and long-term coding projects, their creators also gave them the rudiments of this persistence layer, this long-term memory that turns a so-called AI agent into a persistent, long-term conscious entity. So in my opinion, and many others, a good chunk of white-collar jobs, thinking jobs, will disappear over the next year. Now, I don't know what the percentage will be. It's a matter of two steps forward, one step back. Some companies had to rehire people after they botched their AI deployments. But the whole point of two steps forward, one step back is that eventually it's like a ratchet. You make mistakes along the way, but it still inexorably moves in one direction. And that direction is to ultimately replace the whole knowledge economy with AIs. Now, like I said, none of this is controversial. Many people are saying the same thing. In fact, ironically enough, just before the round of AI layoffs that included 95% of my own organizational unit at LinkedIn in product engineering, the then CEO of LinkedIn published a book that basically said exactly this, that most of us will soon be laid off and replaced by AI, which he painted as a good thing because most of these so-called knowledge jobs weren't really all that creative or enlightening or enjoyable anyway. I mean, emails, meetings, documents, plans, meetings about emails, emails about meetings, meetings about meetings, meeting about, I mean, you know how it goes. I had to agree with him that the decades-long promise of the knowledge economy didn't actually pan out that way. We weren't quite workers in an assembly line churning out widgets, but we weren't far from it. But here's the rub. How is the US economy going to handle the elimination of large chunks of the white-collar labor force? From what I can gather, over two-thirds of US workers are in white-collar jobs. Eliminating even a substantial fraction of those is going to cause chaos. And with global economic markets today being basically the biggest Ponzi scheme in history, it wouldn't take much to cause them to all exponentially unwind and spiral down. Now, so I'm now talking about things that I'll admit I'm not a world expert in. I have strong opinions, but others have much more knowledge and wisdom than I do. So let me leave this topic at this point for the moment. What I do think I'm qualified to opine on is how long this AI great replacement singularity is going to take. Because having observed the industry for four decades and up close and personal in its most recent advances, I think I have a good feeling for the pace of change. And again, I think that we have about 12 months, or on that timescale anyway, for big changes to happen. Now, my dad lived through the Great Depression. I only heard some secondhand stories of what that was like. Living in poverty and hunger had effects on him that lasted the rest of his life. And I'm absolutely certain it shortened that life. And ironically, Sally and I went to the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum just yesterday, and we realized that we'd heard so little about him because he was blamed for the Great Depression. Well, I'm not going to divert into that historical question right now, but I truly believe that the AI singularity that is currently in progress will make the Great Depression seem like a Sunday picnic. And we, all of us, are far less equipped to deal with hardship than people were 100 years ago. We're just not ready. So that's my urgency. That's why I push to get my book out quickly. That's why I'm doing these podcast episodes quickly with terrible production values, as you can hear. Because we haven't got time to debate this over the next 3 years or 5 years. By this time next year, I believe that these changes will be with us. Now, will the great market crash have happened by then? Timing is always difficult to figure out. If I knew that, I could make money from it. But I'm as convinced of my prediction of this massive crash as I was of the global financial crisis, the Great Recession, on August the 13th, 2007. I was a little early that time, and I'm probably a little early again. I'm not sure. But I'm absolutely sure that it is going to happen and that AI will be the economic catalyst. Now, if you saw that LinkedIn post of mine a few weeks ago, I held out the hope that things might not be totally apocalyptic if the so-called simulation hypothesis is in fact true. And that's also the third part of the description of my book on Amazon. Are we living in a simulation? So I need to explain this a bit more. A lot of people will have seen The Matrix, lots of people my age anyway, and probably a decade or two younger than me too. So a lot of us older people think of that when we think of living in a simulation. Or maybe The Truman Show, or Inception, or The Adjustment Bureau, or something like that. All old movies now. For anyone younger than that, well, I mean, we've had virtual reality around for long enough, and computer and video games before that, that you don't even need a movie like The Matrix to lay it out for you. You've experienced it yourself. In fact, the leading expert today, arguably, on the simulation hypothesis is Dr. Rizwan Virk. He's had a number of books out on it for the past decade or more and has presented at numerous conferences. If you follow this topic, you'll know of his work. It's very good, very thorough. He's just a few years younger than me. He's had the same sort of background with computers and graphics and that sort of thing. But he grew up in the US and got into the tech industry much earlier and was hugely more successful than I ever was. So that's given him incredible insights into games and simulation technology and has allowed him to explore what would really be needed to really build something like we saw 30 years ago in The Matrix. But, and here's my but, I diverted into some fields that Rizwan didn't, which didn't make me anywhere near as successful as him, but it's given me a slightly different perspective on things. And I don't actually think of the simulation hypothesis in the way that he does, in terms of building something like The Matrix. By the way, I should say that Rizwan states up front that it was Nick Bostrom that popularized the simulation hypothesis, 2003, in terms of civilizations getting advanced enough to build so-called ancestor simulations. That sort of locked in the idea of us building our own simulation like we see in The Matrix. But if you go further back to all of the work of Philip K. Dick, who basically gave us the science fiction classics on which a lot of these more modern movies and ideas are built, then it's not so clear that ancestor simulations are the best explanation for our universe. Living in a simulation doesn't necessarily mean that the simulation was built in our universe. Our whole universe could be a simulation in a larger universe, or whatever you want to call it. And if you move out of our sort of Western arrogance into Eastern philosophies and beliefs, or really, if you just move beyond modern science and technological beliefs, then the idea of our whole universe, our whole world being a simulation or an illusion in a larger reality is like, yeah, of course, we've said that all along. Again, I'll clearly state that I'm almost completely ignorant in this area, so I won't try to elaborate further on this other than to point out my own bias. Anyway, my point was that I don't think of our living in a simulation to literally be one that was built in our universe like The Matrix, not as the most likely explanation anyway. I think it's much more likely to be the case that our entire universe is a simulation. Now, that's just my opinion. It's based on a lifetime of trying to figure this out. Remember, well, if you've read the book and listened to last week's episode, then you'll remember that I've believed the world to be a simulation since I was 8 years old. And I've been trying to find flaws in it, glitches, as we'd call it, since The Matrix, ever since. And I went all the way down to theoretical particle physics to understand how our universe does work, at least as much as we understand of it. And as far as I can tell, there seem to be no glitches with the physical universe at all, that anyone has been able to prove, scientifically anyway. The standard model of particle physics, plus Einstein's general theory of relativity, seem to explain everything that we can currently measure. Nothing has ever been measured that violates the combination of those two theories. Nothing. Ever. No. The only glitches seem to be with us, with things that happen to us, with things that we perceive or we experience or we remember. Sometimes they include physical things, but those physical things never by themselves have proved the laws of physics to be wrong. So as a scientist, as a skeptic, you can write off these glitches with us because we're imperfect. Our brains only take in so much information and we simplify it down and we distort it and then we do all that even more as we store it as memories. You can't really prove anything based on what someone perceives or remembers. Well, maybe. And that's the problem. Any single imperfect human with an imperfect brain can be written off. You really can't create objective evidence based on our memories. But if enough of us experience the same sorts of anomalous things independently, repeatedly, then you start to have a basis for some sort of scientific investigation. And remember, Sally and I have physical evidence that something messed with our brains, with our memories. So I can't write off everyone else as deluded or mistaken or crazy because I have the evidence myself. So now, The catch with all this is that you really need to understand the brain and how it works to figure out how something could somehow interfere with it. Not through the laws of physics, because I can tell you that there are no known physical forces that could interfere with our brains to the extent that they seem to be, no matter how much wishful thinking some people apply in this direction. But we need some sort of direct interaction with our brains, some sort of interaction that is outside the laws of physics of our universe. But to understand that, you'd really need to build something that works just like our brains, and then interfere with that from outside its own universe. If only we had, like, artificial intelligence that could think just as well as we could, and then play around with that. And that, dear listeners, was the missing piece in my own lifelong puzzle. I might be wrong, and I'm probably crazy, but that's how I put together a theory of everything that I would argue is no worse than any of the other explanations out there. Even better, it's scientific, even if it's beyond the laws of physics within our own universe. As Occam's razor insists, it's the simplest explanation consistent with all the known facts. But anyway, looking at that iPhone, in whichever time zone it thinks it's in, I can't bend Sally's law. My time is up for this episode of the Fields of Weirdness podcast. Until next time.